Hi, you're listening to the Fictoplasm podcast, where we discuss our favourite works of fiction and how to turn them into role-playing games of some form or another. I'm your host, Ralph. There may be a few spoilers. Hello, welcome to another episode of Fictoplasm. This episode, I'm joined by series regular Mo.
Hello.
And I have a special guest, which is Tom McGrenery.
Hello.
Tom very kindly suggested a book for us, so we read it, and now we're going to talk about it. Tom, would you like to introduce the book?
Okay, yeah. It is Pale Fire by Vladimir Nabokov, which is...
Excellent.
Do I need to do a précis, or... It's quite difficult to précis,
well,
actually.
Yes, it's a bit of a challenge. Why don't you tell us why you thought it was particularly interesting for us to tackle?
Oh, well, the inspiration to recommend it was when you covered The Prisoner of Zenda, which, of course, is the prototypical Ruritanian romance. And that just made me think of Pale Fire, because one of the plot strands within it is precisely that, a Ruritania. But as for why, in general, I would recommend it, it's just because it's a really excellent novel. And for a long time, I know that I was put off by how complex it sounds, the structure which we'll get into later. And I sort of want other people to not be put off by it, because once I took the plunge, I found out that it's a book that really has everything in it. It's, you know, it's sad, it's funny, it's got an adventure, it's got humdrum life, it's clever, it's silly. I mean, it's really a very... It's just a worthwhile read.
I agree. I know it's the first time I actually read it. Mo, I think years ago you recommended it to Liz. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. When I read it when I was sort of 19 or 20, I think, first, and I was completely blown away by it. It is just, you know, tremendously clever, enjoyable, funny, all the things that Tom said, and I serially recommend it to people to read. But yeah, the structure can be off-putting, and I guess we're going to talk about that. That's also part of what makes it tremendously interesting.
Okay, well, who's going to do the synopsis?
Tom.
Okay.
You've been volunteered. Excellent.
Wow, okay. All right. Okay, so the central plank of the book, if we can call it that, is a poem called Pale Fire by a character called John Shade. It's a long poem. It's 1,000 lines long, although the first and last are the same, so maybe it's one shorter. And he is a sort of respected American poet whose full-time job is as a professor of English at an East Coast US university. I think that's about right for where it is. But this is complicated by the presence of what is before and after the poem. The foreword and the end notes are the words of a guy called Kinboat, who is, as we're given to understand, he's another teacher in the literature department at Wordsworth College. But he appears to believe that he is the last king of this Ruritanian nation, possibly in the Baltic, it's hard to tell, it's near Russia, we think, called Nova Zembla. But he is now living in exile after a communist coup. And the thing is that he is an absolute pompous, self-involved buffoon. And his notes are mostly talking about himself. There'll be a part of the poem, there's a numbered footnote, and you go to that, and he goes off on a completely different tangent, talking about his escape from Nova Zembla, or he makes some fatuous remark about literature in general, or he's misunderstood the context. So he's constantly talking in a puffed-up way throughout these references about how he was a great friend of John Shade, and about the way that he, or rather the king, because he tries to not let on that he thinks he is the king of Nova Zembla, but how he escaped. And so the default reading is that this guy Kinboat is probably delusional. It's unlikely he's actually the king of this country. Might be suicidal. But that the authorship of the book is as it's presented, so that John Shade wrote the poem and Kinboat wrote the foreword and the notes. But it's possible to argue for, and has been argued for, that there are different readings. And then, of course, the real trick of the book is that all of this is a lie, because the author is Vladimir Nabokov, and he even alludes to himself at one point in the footnotes. He's the author. There is no John Shade. There is no Kinboat or King. And that, I think, is one of the most interesting things about the experience of reading the book, is as you become aware of these different levels.
Yeah. Mo, anything to add?
That's a terrific summary, and it is complex. It is fun. I guess the third sort of narrative thread is the arrival in, or the journey to America, of the assassin, Gradus, who Kimbo believes has been sent after him, after King Charles the Well-Beloved, to assassinate him, but he ends up killing John Shade at the end of the footnotes, which is how come Kimbo is publishing Shade's last manuscript in this kind of heavily annotated and distorted form. And there is a... it's very hard to talk about the shifting levels of reality. There is a reading in which Kimboat is a delusion of another member of the faculty at New Y, a professor of Russian called Vzeslav Botkin, and that the assassin Gradus is actually an escaped American convict called Jack Gray, who was attempting to assassinate the judge from whom Kimboat or Botkin is renting his house. But to try and make sense of that, you've really got to read it. Clues are kind of scattered throughout the text in sort of various different ways and different sort of angles of allusion, and to try and assemble it together into a jigsaw that kind of makes sense and shows a consistent picture is sort of fascinating while also being frustrating. And one of the things which I'm really intrigued by as a sort of not very literary person is whether the poem itself, Pale Fire, is supposed to be good. Because to me, it reads as quite sort of shallow and jejune, but, you know, Shade is presented as being a well-thought-of poet. Is it that Nabokov himself is not very good at writing American lyric poetry, or is it that he was deliberately doing it badly? And you know, how can we ever know? That's one of the puzzles which is probably going to stay with me.
Yeah, I actually tried to ask myself that question about the poem on purpose this time when I was reading it, but it's so difficult to concentrate on the poem that I still don't know.
Well, I came to it fresh, and I understand there are two ways of reading it. Obviously, you've got you could read it straight through, or you can jump from parts of the poem to the footnote. And I thought the poem at least came across as quite coherent. But then I'm no judge of poetry either. But I've only read it once now. I do intend to go back and read it as a more, hypertextual novel, which is, in fact, it helps me having electronic versions of this. That's really convenient. You can jump all over the place in the book. I guess it would be interesting to do that with the paper copy, because you've got the haptic feedback of going back and forward with the pages, which is also, I think, the point of novels like House of Leaves is the actual, well, that's an enormous book that, and you're actually supposed to suffer through that. I thought that it made a lot of sense on a linear reading. And I imagine it would make a different sense as, say, it read non-sequentially. Can I ask if you read it non-sequentially or sequentially when you first read it on repeat readings, Tom?
Oh, so this time round, which is my, I guess, second full read of it, and in that I've dipped into it again in the past, I tried my best to go sequentially, because the first time I did do that, I'd followed every note, and then I would follow the notes that are in the notes the first time I read it. I think that's slightly the more fun way to read it, because to the extent that there are spoilers in the book, which, given that it tells you everything that happens right at the beginning, there aren't, but the order in which things get revealed, I think if you follow that kind of Wikipedia-style rabbit hole thing, you'll find a quite pleasing sequence to them. I think it isn't quite as good if you do read sequentially, but it's hard. I wouldn't want to stake my reputation on that.
I mostly read it that way from time pressure, because it's so. I think I was reading it on my Kindle, and I was just that's a nightmare to go back and forth through. So, Mo, did you read it sequentially?
Yes, I always have read it sequentially in the way that Tom describes. But there is something else, which is that Kimboat or Botkin compiled an index to the poem, and in the index there are further clues hidden. So if you do just read the text and the footnotes, you'd have no reason to consult the index, and so you will miss some stuff. So I kind of read that as a separate meta text afterwards, just to make sure that I've picked up on everything that's concealed in there.
Excellent. Okay, well, is there anything more to say on the synopsis?
I'm not sure. There's just so much going on in there. It's hard to think of.
Well, there is, but then it seems to boil down to, as you previously said, there's John Shade as the author of the poem and Kim Boat's notes, but then he's narrating three different threads, which is his own life, the life of King Charles II, and the bumbling assassin Gradus. Sorry.
Never sure.
And you've got those three separate strands, which I guess are interweaved in the way that you'd expect in an ordinary novel. And it ends with, you know, hilarious consequences.
kind of. There is one more thing to say, I guess, which is that Kinboat is a very interesting example of an unreliable narrator. Like, it's kind of a masterclass in it. Because if you compare to, like, Lolita, that's a very kind of one level of, like, you're reading differently underneath the text. Whereas Kinboat is often hilarious because of, sometimes he's obviously lying to you, or other times he's clearly misapprehended the situation. Or sometimes he seems to just have made a mistake and a slip and told you something he didn't mean to. And the sheer number of different ways in which he is unreliable are quite impressive.
Yeah. So normally we start with a synopsis and then we do some comments on. And so I think we've come to the end of the commentary. Is that fair to say?
And what, do you want to bring out anything about the Ruritan theme?
Yeah, that's one thing I think we'd like to...
That relates to other stuff in the same genre and that sort of thing. Mm.
I've got some notes about the Ruritania thing, but more as it pertains to gaming, so maybe I should save that, and if you go ahead with...
That's cool. Mo, do you want to expand your...
No, not really, because to me the themes are not so interesting as the structure, and it's the structure which is informing my gaming thoughts as well. So maybe it'd be better to take the textual stuff first.
Well, it sounds like actually we're ready to move on to the gaming bit because we are naturally going to be talking about the Ruritanian themes.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah.
Let's talk about games now. After that analysis, Mo, would you like to kick us off?
Yeah. Okay. So what interested me on rereading it for this for Fictoplasm purposes and thinking about game design was the kind of fractal nature of the story. So the way that you can pick up a thread and then follow it down and that leads you to another thread, and the different strands of the narrative open up in different directions and you can pursue them more or less as you wish. And this made me think of a game called Kaleidoscope by Jackson Tegu. So I guess most people listening to this will probably be familiar with Ben Robbins's game Microscope, which is about fractal exploration of history. So you set up a timeline and you can sort of drill down into and pick out scenes and themes and characters who are particularly interesting and build a story between you around the table using this kind of nice structure. So Jackson Tegu did a hack of that, which is called Kaleidoscope, and it is about you play a group of friends who have just watched a European art house movie which you didn't understand at all. And you use a microscope-like structure to kind of put together impressions about it and stuff that might have happened in it and thoughts that it kind of generated in you, but you weren't quite sure what they meant. And it's just a very funny, fun experience of kind of basically bullshitting around a table, building a story that doesn't have to make sense, but that can be crammed full of illusion and reincorporation and all of the things which make live story building a fun thing to do. And so I thought a similar sort of hack might work well for a story that has this sort of multidimensional unreliability of the narrator that Tom was just talking about. So, you know, you can build without necessarily knowing what the core story is actually about. You can set up angles into it and different kind of narratorial voices and approaches to it. As a skeleton, and then kind of drill in and put detail around it and fill in scenes and elements from that. And I thought that might be quite a fun thing to do. I've got no idea whether it would actually work or not, but it seems to me that if it does work in... Well, it definitely does work in Kaleidoscope, and this is really pretty similar. And the one thing it's lacking is a clever name that ends in scope, which I've not had time to think of yet, but maybe listeners to the podcast will come up with something.
Endoscope. maybe not. So let's think about, sort of unpack that a bit. How would that work? You've got in Power 5, you're using the central piece of art, which you are using, I guess, to kick off a whole load of ideas, is a poem. Is it possible to pick on any piece of art or art house film or literary passage or something and improvise like
I do
this?
Wonder about that. So I was thinking about, you know, open a book of poetry at random and pick something out. So, for example, in his bit of reincorporation, Pale Fire makes reference to Keats' sonnet on first looking into Chapman's Homer, and there's a very funny joke about that, which I won't spoil for you. So could one build a story around that? It's Keats's account of his own experiences on reading this translation of Homer into English and the way it kind of blew his mind. So you could have an approach that's about Keats as he was writing it, about Chapman as he was doing the translation, about Homer, if Homer even existed, or whether his works were written by another man of the same name, as the story goes. And then there's the impressions of the readers who are reading the metatext, as it were. So I think it would be possible to have a lot of fun with an existing text for people who were familiar with it and who were of a literary bent. But I think for a general gaming approach, it might be better to make something up out of whole cloth that doesn't have to make sense or be coherent in the way that Kaleidoscope does. So rather than being based on an actual movie, it is just, I have a vague memory that this movie might have been about so-and-so, and people just riff from there into free space.
It did strike me that Kimbo is, he could, if there's an argument that he's making the whole thing up as he goes along, and John Shade's poem is a real thing, but what he's doing is, as you say, going off onto different tangents. He's effectively participating in that kind of improvisational exercise.
There is a school of thought which says that Kimboat or even Botkin don't actually exist within the frame of the book, and that John Shade invented that person as a kind of a fictional editor within the context of which to present his poem to make it more interesting. And there's a competing school of thought which tells that John Shade doesn't exist, and that Kimboat himself or Botkin invented the character of John Shade and the poem as a frame for putting his story of Zembla around. So this kind of messing around with levels of narration is very much in the spirit of the novel, if we can call it a novel. And I think any kind of game deriving from it that plays with that and that leaves people unsure of what level of reality they're sort of precariously standing is going to be fun to play.
Oh, I do like the sound of Kaleidoscope.
You should check it out. It's on Jackson Tegu's website. It costs $8, and it's very well presented. It's designed to be played by non-gamers. It's very simple, and a lot of fun around the table with a few drinks.
Groovy. Okay, Tom, have you got something role-playing related you'd like to talk about?
I do. I was not able to think in terms of the structure quite as well as Mo did as to how to apply that in a game. The closest I got was that Cheat Your Own Adventure reminds me of the abandoned drafts that you find in some of the footnotes, but I don't think you can do a lot with that. But I think that the theme of a Ruritania has, in Pale Fire, sort of has a lesson for our games generally, which is that within the book, Nova Zembla is an obvious Ruritania. It's sort of a fictional place that resembles a real one, but, you know, obviously is not. But there's also New Y, which is the college town where the kind of more believable action takes place. But that's a Ruritania as well. I mean, it resembles an East Coast college town, but it's totally fictional. And it's very interesting that we are able to accept the reality of New Y a lot more easily than we are of Nova Zembla. And as you know, I'm very interested in historical gaming. For me, it's a sort of way of living out social history of things. And I'm often a little frustrated with the fear that people have of quote-unquote getting things wrong. And it's a thing that, you know, it's easy to fall into. I've done it myself. But you can see that there are, especially in games and settings that are closer to the modern day, so like New Y in Pale Fire, or Groversville in the famous-ish original Delta Green scenario, Convergence, where, you know, these places are not at all real, but that doesn't seem to bother us in the same way that historical, in quotes again, gaming does. And I think it's useful to take that on board, this idea that we can still, for temporary purposes, believe in a place. I mean, even if you have a generic modern day game, ever since you stepped into the cafe where you play or wherever, that modern day hasn't existed. You're sort of remembering what you saw 10 minutes ago. So you're always needing to inhabit a fictionalized version of the real world at best.
I do like the use of imaginary places that you can travel to, and I sort of partly alluded to this with the Zenda episode, but thinking of things like games like Over the Edge with Alamage, and of course that's riffing off Interzone and places like that, which supposedly are real. Of course, those are places which the point of view character or the PCs can travel to and do things that and have experiences that they don't normally experience. I guess if you have a place that looks totally plausible, but we actually know it not to exist, then that's the question about how does that affect our perception of the narrative and of the game. So what would happen if you called the existence of this perfectly coherent, very real feeling place into question? What happens to the inhabitants?
Well, that's the interesting thing, I think. I mean, from a, you know, your sort of out of character perspective as a player, we're very, or reader, I think, in the case of a novel, we're very armoured emotionally against irony. Like, if you, there's the section in Pale Fire in which the poem describes how Hazel, the Shade's daughter, dies. It's pretty sad. And the fact is that if you've just hopped in from a footnote by Kinboat, he was just doing some kind of idiotic joke and you were laughing. And then you're right back in the poem and you feel sad about it again. Even though you know that this is a sort of character that doesn't exist and is being partly deconstructed by the text. And it's in the same way that you can be playing... I remember once running a Call of Cthulhu scenario, Secret of Castronegra, good one, in an Irish pub with top 40 music playing on the jukebox. And despite the fact that all the setting was wrong, you know, we should have been detached, we were still able to experience the kind of the correct essential emotions. So in a way... he said, eventually getting around to answering the question, I think that the reality or lack of it of the characters is something that's very easy to not care about.
And is there then more of a distancing effect in the Zembla sections, because that's sort of somehow less real in a way than UY? So when people die in Zembla, do we care about them less than we care about Hazel Shade?
I think we do, and that's the real question, is why do we find her reality more real? Because you've got to remember, it's not like we're having one extra layer. Obviously, there's Nabokov, and then the character who's telling us about Nova Zembla is a fictional one. But the character who's telling us about Hazel is also a fictional character. So it is that, I think it's that more familiar setting.
Yeah.
And just being a what appears to be a more believable writer.
It makes you, talking about New Y, it makes me think of Jason Morningstar's game, The Shabalhiri Roach, which is set in an American university campus in which the faculty are kind of monsters of pride and resentment, and essentially spend the whole time screwing each other over. And it's, you know, it is a very funny game to play, but during the course of it, lots and lots of people get killed in you know, grotesque and disgusting ways. But, they, in my mind, are in a different category from Hazel Shade and John Shade. Maybe because John Shade writes about his daughter's death in a moving way rather than in a comic way. I don't know.
Yes, yeah, so I thought about the Shabalhiri Roach as well. I think, obviously, the setting, and it has some similarities to the sort of drawing room dramas that we hear about when Kinboat is going around the college in the novel. But I think if you were trying to do Pale Fire, the RPG, you would not be well served by doing.
There's a challenge.
Not that I'm suggesting that you were suggesting that, by the way.
There's a challenge, listeners.
Yeah, there you
first
go.
Person to do it gets a prize.
All right. I was thinking when I was writing my notes about this, about places where the real world intrudes on fiction. So going back to one of the things I originally thought about in the Zender episode was the idea about people in the real world going into this this other country, whether it's fantastical like Narnia or whether it's simply another country that has its own politics and appears to be consistent with our world, but it is nevertheless not the same place. But what happens, people come back from that country and instead the fiction from that country intrudes on the real world. We've got an example of that with Becky Anderson's When the Dark is Gone, which is the whole point about that is you've gone to a fictional place and you come back and it is now affecting you in ways which are mature themed and they have real consequences. It's not whimsical. But also the question of whether you actually experienced what you say you experienced is always there. There's always a lack of trust that that what you experienced in this fantasy world was not a delusion. The other thing I was thinking about is going to fictional places themselves. Things like I don't know if you know Warren Ellis's Planetary, and there's a I think it's episode 9 where they land a spaceship on Planet Fiction. And something supposedly weird, preternatural, or just so totally alien to normal reality manages to get back from Planet Fiction into the real world. I think I've remembered that correctly. Now, I'm not suggesting that something like Gradius is anything so grand as a great old one or a peculiar creeping horror, and of course is a fairly just inefficient assassin. But what if Gradius was actually some stalking horror that came from a place that you know doesn't exist? How do you tackle that danger? I don't know if either of you've seen the film It Follows.
No. Not yet. No.
I do recommend it. It's quite horrific in that not really gory. That there's a couple of bits of sort of people being beaten up, but generally it's there's such a total sense of dread and horror. And the main thing is it follows a creature that follows one relentlessly that only you can see. No one else can see it. No one else believes in it. But nevertheless, it is a real threat to you and forces you to be forever on your guard. So, if you are certain that there is a fantasy realm and something from that realm is stalking you, but a lot of other people don't actually believe in the realm, they're pretty much powerless to help you in dealing with whatever threat that is facing you. And that kind of, it means that you can use that to draw a magic circle around the PCs compared to, let's say you have a fictionalized but real world setting where most people don't believe in monsters. They also don't believe in this mythical Eastern European country or whatever, but you do, and that's why the threat from that country is relevant to you. And then I can imagine having a very interesting and weird spy type game where you and the other PCs are, for some reason, you have a connection with this fantasy place, and they've now sent assassins after you to kill you, and belief in the other country is what gives it power. So that's the sort of thing I was thinking of. And then combating that, you've got to somehow diminish your belief in that in order to actually combat the threat that's attacking you. So then you've got any location that is tied to this fictional world, any people that are tied to it, they will gain power or lose power depending on how much the people in their proximity to them believe in it. That was kind of my loose idea. I think it could be quite fun to run a short one. Not sure.
Yeah, I think that sounds really compelling, the idea of the sort of assassin's progress across Europe or wherever. I think one thing you could do to kind of perhaps make use of the liminal connection between PC and player is to basically, you could force the players to be involved in that progress. So perhaps when certain events are triggered, you know, in a PBTA thing that might be on a 6-minus, one person has to describe where the assassin is now and what they're doing. And you would find, I think, you don't even have to give particular incentives to make that quite bad or menacing. People will want to one-up each other. Anyway, so that would be a good way to sort of build the dread and make you responsible for your own intimidation at the same time.
That's a great idea. And that, I guess, if you had a track that indicated the closer that the assassin was getting to you, you could that could go up and go down. And once it reaches a critical point, then the hard moves that are taken against the players when they fail become more consequential because they're actually directly being attacked by the assassin or something.
Right, yeah, it opens up a whole section of new hard moves available, perhaps, yeah.
So, yeah, you could mechanise that quite effectively, I think.
I like that it's a good explanation for why other people can't get involved or can't be appealed to. That's the sort of the alienation of the players by the fact that they've got this contagion and other people don't is a nice sort of simple and clear method for you know, containing play in a playable way. I like it.
Cool. Are we coming towards the close? Is there any last words you'd like to say? Tom?
No, I think we've done a reasonably good job of covering everything, although it's, as we've mentioned, it's such a sort of multifaceted novel, Palefire, that it's quite hard to do it justice just talking about it in anything under a novel-length treatise, I imagine. So I just encourage people to read it for themselves and see what we're on about.
Excellent. Mo?
I think, you know, if listening to the three game ideas or game thoughts that it sparked in us, they're all completely different and coming from wildly different directions to the material. And I think that shows, like Tom said, how multifaceted Palefire is and how much it rewards exploration. So I can only add, you know, if you haven't read it, go out and read it. But if you have read it, go out and reread it and let it blow your mind again. It's definitely worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. Tom, thanks very much for suggesting it, because I would never have read it if you hadn't commented. So, that's been great.
You're very welcome.
Yeah. So, two thumbs up. All right, then. I think that's the podcast. So, just for me to say thank you very much to Tom for being our guest.
Thank you.
And to Mo for joining us again.
Thank you.
And that's it. Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you've got comments, we'd love to hear them. We're on the web and on social media. Details at fictoplasm.net. Until next time, bye.